We are concluding today the study of Mystery Babylon, chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation. You'll recall from our previous work that Mystery Babylon is that evil power which expresses man's rebellion against God through his institutions. And we've seen that the three primary institutions that this rebellion is expressed in: man's government, man's business, and man's churches. This, of course, represents government, the power of politics; business, the power of money; and the church, the power of religion. Now, Satan knows that man is incurably religious, and so Satan does not try to destroy religion. Satan tries to divert man's attention from worship of God to worship of him. And he does it, of course, by counterfeiting everything. The mother-child relationship, which was established by Nimrod in the Babylonian mystery cult through his wife Semiramis and their son Tammuz, has permeated Mystery Babylon's teaching throughout the ages, and we see it even today. The cults, of course, that have been established also throughout the world, throughout the ages, all rely on the same kinds of counterfeit things. They all have priests, they all have sacrifices, they all emphasize very heavily the importance of love. You may have seen in the paper this morning, in the Post, the story of a local doctor who has embraced a cult, and the emphasis that he has placed on this embracing is that it has taught him the importance of loving and of sharing. It always sounds so good. It would be wonderful if Satan's plan were more readily identifiable by being exclusively confined to ugly and evil people, but he's much too intelligent for that. The design is then to lure away people from God, lure away some. Those that he can't lure away, he attempts to drive away. Those that he can't drive away, he tries to turn off. Now, there was a time in history that we've studied earlier together in Revelation when these three elements of Babylonianism were all blended. And that, of course, is in 312 A.D. when Constantine, the Roman emperor, embraced Christianity. He saw what was reputed to be a cross in the sky and a voice that said, "In this sign, conquer." And so the church married the world. The church and state became one and stayed one, of course, until the Reformation. Now, some see signs of a trend toward reblending today. Some straws in the wind, perhaps. In Central America, in Nicaragua, there is a priest who presently serves in the government, the Sandinistas. The so-called World Council of Churches. 2 weeks ago in the Chronicle, it was announced they have sent $200,000 to the African National Congress, which, of course, is the Marxist organization that is attempting to overthrow the government of South Africa. All sorts of things. The ecumenical movement, then, is seen by some as gaining momentum toward one world, this great amalgamation of the three principal kinds of powers, not uniting all things in heaven and earth in Christ, as Paul says God will do as the age comes to a close, but it's man's attempt to unite all things in man. Now, of course, we've seen a great historical principle, which is God gathers all of his enemies together in great power and amalgamation in order to destroy them. You've seen that in the Bible, in the story of Pharaoh. All of the hosts of Pharaoh gathered together so that God could conveniently close the waters of the sea on them and drown them. The story of the Philistines in the temple, when Samson was brought there to be ridiculed and instead pulled the temple down around the gathered hosts. I heard this past week a great anecdote about Chesty Puller. Some of you who have been in the Marine Corps know who Chesty Puller was, a great Marine general who, when the Chinese came across the ice in Korea, and there were Chinese to the right, Chinese to the left, Chinese to the front, and the reservoir behind, Chesty Puller said, "Good, we've got them now, they can't escape." This is kind of the way God does. He gets all the enemies together in order that they might be destroyed. So when you see great godless groups gathering together against you, well, just rejoice. Rejoice, because it means that God is active in history. Now, let's get the chronology straight of chapter 17 and 18. Chapter 17 is the record of the judgment of the religious aspect of Mystery Babylon. This is Christianity without Christ, false religion, but intensely religious without any real worship. We'll go through chapter 17 quickly just hitting some high spots. 17, 7 through 8. When I saw her, speaking of the harlot mystery Babylon, I marveled greatly, but the angel said, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was, is not, and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to behold the beast, because it was, is not, and is to come." We've seen together before, of course, that the beast represents the Antichrist. He carries the harlot who represents Mystery Babylon, this great world church that has come together in its anti-religious form. The church then, for the first part of the tribulation, dominates the state. But finally, the state, as the power of the Antichrist continues to grow, is able to overthrow the Mystery Babylon religion, and then to take all religious power also to himself as the Antichrist sets himself up in the temple to be worshipped. This business about he was, he is, and he will be, of course, we've seen refers to another counterfeiting plan of the Antichrist, which is to counterfeit his own death and his own resurrection, because he tries to copy everything that God has done. Chapters 9, verses 9 through 11, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman was seated. There are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. That he is referring to the Antichrist. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to perdition. Now that sounds hopelessly tangled, but as we've seen before, it's really simple once you get the clues. And the clues, of course, are these. The seven mountains refer to Rome, and we're to think of Rome as it was, because the Roman Empire is going to be reestablished in these closing days. Seven kings, five have fallen, one is, and one is not yet to come, and then there's an eighth. The five that have fallen refers historically to the five kingdoms that preceded the kingdom of Rome, the Empire of Rome. All of these were dominated by the mystery Babylonian cults. The first one, of course, was Assyria. And we have all read volumes about Nineveh and the terrible things that went on there. The second kingdom that followed the Assyrian kingdom, of course, was the Egyptian kingdom. And that kingdom was also very much under the sway of the occult and the black magic arts. The third, after the fall of the Egyptian kingdom, was the Babylonian kingdom. We have good records of that because Daniel was present, of course, during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. The fourth kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the one that overthrew the Babylonians when Babylon itself fell. And then fifth, the kingdom of Alexander the Great under his remarkable, brief, but dramatic career, the fifth kingdom being Greece. Then it says these five kingdoms have fallen. There's one that is. Well, of course, during John's time, Rome was the one that was. So that was the one that was established. There is one yet to come. This is the seventh kingdom, or the reestablished kingdom. The Antichrist is referred to as being an eighth king, but it says he is of the seventh. So it's seen that the Antichrist starts off as being sort of a part of all of that which is happening during the tribulation. He takes over, consolidates both his secular and his religious power, and finally becomes the great single world leader. Now remember, all of these kingdoms have in common their total commitment to the black arts and to the worship of the occult. There is, in 12 and 14, an interesting footnote. The ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind and give over their power and authority to the beast, and so on. Well, this is that coalition that is formed with all of the kingdoms of the then existing world during the time of the tribulation with the Antichrist. All political power being consolidated in one great coalition which moves against Israel, that of course bringing about the final intervention of Christ in the second coming. Now, chronologically again, the overthrow of the harlot, which represents false religion, takes place, we learn from Matthew and from Daniel, about the midpoint of the tribulation. And that's what chapter 17 deals with. Now, chapter 17 and 18 together set the stage for the conclusion of the book of Revelation and for the glorious coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, the second coming of the Messiah. Chapter 17, destruction of religious Babylon. Chapter 18 is the destruction of the secular manifestation of Babylon, the political as well as the economic. That occurs at the end of the tribulation. So first destruction at the middle point of the tribulation of religious Babylon, and then the final destruction at the end of the seven-year period when Christ returns in glory. Now the form of chapter 18 is what's called in the Old Testament a doom song, a doom song. And in reading the Old Testament, you've seen lots of those. In Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Jeremiah, very frequently the warnings about destruction were put into verse and they were sung. And this is a New Testament version of the doom song. And we're going to look at it in five parts. First, we're going to note the character of the destruction. And then we're going to hear four things. We're going to hear a call, we're going to hear a cry, we're going to hear a croaking, and we're going to hear a chorus. Let's look at the opening stanzas of the doom song, Revelation 18, 1 through 8. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. The earth was made bright with his splendor. He called out in a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit, a haunt of every foul bird and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk the wine of her impure passion, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich with the wealth of her wantonness." Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquity. Render to her as she herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double draft for her of the cup she mixed, as she glorified herself and played the wanton. So give her a like measure of torment and mourning, since in her heart she says, 'A queen I sit, I am no widow. Mourning I shall never see.' So shall her plagues come in a single day, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she shall be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her." Let's look at the character of the destruction. First, the character of destruction. The destruction is total. 18:2, fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great. It's become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit, of every foul and hateful bird. The picture here is a destruction that is so total that it's like the bottom of a cage where a group of buzzards have been caged up. Total, complete destruction. When God moves in his destructive power and might, the destruction is absolutely total. You recall in the Old Testament, Joshua and many other places, when the enemies of God are put to rout, God always admonishes his people to destroy everything. That is a picture for us of the necessity of remembering that God destroys totally all evil which comes into his presence. The destruction here of this section of the Babylonian mystery is absolutely total. It is also sudden. 8:8. So shall her plagues come in a single day. Over in 8:17, in 1 hour, all of this wealth has been laid waste. Marsh and I are basketball fans, and one of the reasons we love professional basketball is because the reaction time of the great professional players is almost zero. These guys are so marvelously well coordinated. On a fast break, they're bringing the ball down the court. There's no way to know where the ball is going to end up. But the one thing all the pro players learn very quickly is always expect the ball is going to be passed to you. And almost never do they miss. Reaction time is incredible. But in God's judgment, there's no such thing as reaction time that's quick enough. Because when the judgment comes, it is instantaneous. At one moment, everything is the same as it always was. In the blink of an eye, everything is in flames. We'll see that in a moment. Two characters then of the destruction of God of Babylon. It is total and it is absolutely overwhelmingly sudden. The third characteristic is that it balances the scales. 8:6. Render to her as she herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double draft for her in the cup that she mixed. What poetic justice that is, in the very cup that the wanton harlot Babylon is seen as mixing the potion which made drunk all of the kings of the earth. In that same cup, the potion that God requires her to drink is mixed. Under Jewish law, in certain cases where wrong had been done, restitution was required double. Twice whatever had been misappropriated, twice whatever had been stolen. John's Jewish readers would know of that. The principle, of course, is set in granite. We hear this echoing throughout all of the scriptures. You get what you give. Whatever it is that you sow is what you reap. I heard a story this week of a young agricultural student who was trying to impress an old farmer. He was driving down the road and saw the old farmer standing looking over the fence at his field, and so he got out of his car and he walked over and he said, "You know, I'm a second-year agricultural student." And the farmer said, "That's nice." And he looked out at the field, and the little crop was just about this high. And the student shook his head. He said, "You know," he said, "that's a mighty sorry." He said, "I doubt that that field will make 5 bushels of corn to the acre." The farmer said, "Won't make that much. Planting wheat." Whatever you plant is what you're going to reap. Whatever you sow is what will come back to you again. And we're reminded in 8:7 of another aspect of this. "As she glorified herself and played the wanton, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning, since in her heart she says, 'A queen I sit, I am no widow, mourning I shall never see.'" Particularly those who sow arrogance reap humiliation. And that's what's going to happen to the great, arrogant, mystery Babylon. Our son, Jack, who's living and working in the real estate business in Austin, has begun to take a Dale Carnegie course to help his salesmanship. And this past week, we had a couple of days together, and he was reviewing some of the things that they've been learning there. And one of the great things that he's been able to put into practice, they've taught him a way to remember people's names, which in selling is very important. And also, he said, "Dad, you'll be amazed. They've told us 2 things to do. One, remember people's names. The other thing is to smile." He said, "If you just remember a guy's name," he said, "you know, I tried that out the other day. I had to go up to the Veterans Land Board, and I walked up, and the secretary was sitting there, and I stuck out my hand. I said, 'Hi, how are you?' 'Great, fine.' He said, 'I've been up there 3 or 4 times, and every time I go up there, that secretary comes over and says, 'Can I do anything for you? Is there anything that you need?'" He said, "It's tremendous." He said, "It really is true that you can get more flies with honey than you can with vinegar." What a revelation, see? He's only been around for 23 years. He's already picked that up. And you know, I've learned another of God's great principles, which he speaks to a father's heart, and that is, you can't tell nobody nothing. But it really is true. In our relationship with people, we see this principle illustrated in so many ways. And God reminds us here that he's going to balance the scales, that as you sow, shall you reap. And in the case of Mystery Babylon, she's going to reap terrible destruction and terrible humiliation. Well, that's the character of the destruction. Now let's look at the call the faithful. 18:4. "Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins and lest you share in her plagues.'" Now, in the Old Testament, God's people are always being called to come out. They were called to come out of Egypt. Egypt was, of course, the place of bondage, but it was also a place of terrific appeal and of allure. God called his people to come out of the world. God, of course, in the person of Lot, called his people to come out of Sodom before Sodom was destroyed. And Lot came out, and his wife longingly looked back on that terrible place, and of course, was turned into a pillar of salt. We're supposed, as Christians, of course, to be in and not of the world. We're supposed to be transformed by God and not conformed to the world. But this passage tells us at least 2 reasons why it's important that that be so. If we stay in, the passage says, 2 things can happen. 1, you might take part in the sins, and 2, you might share in the plagues. We might get sucked in, and then if we do, we're going to suffer terribly for it. You know, one of the things that I expect that Satan likes to hear most from the lips of a Christian is, "I can handle it. I can handle it." I've heard this over the years from kids, and I'm still hearing this with respect to drugs. "Well, yeah, I know that drugs are bad news, and some people get hooked, but let me tell you, I can handle it. I can handle it." Marcia and I are at the age now that some of our friends are to the place where they are hearing that old whisper come out of the jug, see, because they're saying to themselves, "I know that at about this age, some people get hooked on booze. You see, I can handle it. I can handle it. There's no problem with it. Well, I come home and I have a little martini, and then I have a little brandy and some wine with some dinner, and when I tote it all up, I've had about a quart for the day, but I can handle it, see." It happens. We get sucked in. You know, there's one that for men, you ladies don't have to listen to this, but there's one that for men that's particularly subtle, and that is the question of lust. Now, as young men, we dealt with that. Of course, as mature men, we don't have that problem anymore. And so it's safe for us to buy Playboy and read it for the articles in it. I mean, we just like the editorial content. And, you know, we've laughed before at Goldwater's story, saying Hubert Humphrey spoke so fast on the Senate floor that listening to him speak was like trying to read Playboy with your wife turning the pages. Well, if you've got a copy of that book at home, you better read it with your wife turning the pages, friend, because that stuff plays with your mind. You get sucked in. The passage tells you that if you take part in the sins, you can share in the plagues. We say to God, look, God, this is just small potatoes. This is small potatoes. And what God says is it's deadly poison. Not small potatoes. It's deadly poison. I have a friend who says that he's got sort of a rule of thumb for gray area things, not knowing whether he really ought to be involved in them or not. And his rule of thumb is, if you have in mind going someplace or doing something, ask God to come along with you. And if he won't, don't. Pretty good advice. Sometimes I believe as Christians that we think we've become bulletproof because we're saved. Salvation, of course, is both past, present, and future. In the past, we have been delivered from the power of sin. In the future, we are delivered from the penalty of sin. All of that's taken care of by the blood of Christ. But in the present, we are being delivered from the presence of sin. That process is not complete. And therefore, sin has at least two powerful impacts on the life of the Christian who ignores this passage and refuses to come out. One, it can make you sick enough to die. Sick enough to die. Paul talks about that. He speaks of the sickness unto death. For Kierkegaard, it was the fear and the trembling, the sickness unto death. There is some suggestion in the Scripture that Christians can become themselves so involved in sin, so far lost in sin, haven't lost their salvation, but they've become totally immersed in it, so sick that God just brings them on home, takes them out of the physical life here and brings them home. So one consequence of becoming involved in this process of not coming out is that we become so sick that we can die. The second, of course, is that we become useless, and even worse than useless. We're useless in that we're no witness. Our light goes out. Those who look at us as witnesses for Christ say, boy, you know, if that's a Christian, who needs Christ? And the second thing is we're, as sick soldiers, we can't fight in the battle, and we drag down those who are attempting to do so. So, salvation doesn't make us bulletproof. As Christians, we are reminded of that by this call to the faithful. Well, let's look next at the cry of the captains and the kings. 18:9, the cry of the captains and the kings. And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and were wanton with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. And then 17 through 19, in 1 hour this wealth has been laid waste, and all the shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors and all who trade is on the sea, stood afar off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads, the sign of mourning. They wept and they mourned and cried out, alas, alas for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. In 1 hour it has been laid waste. What a vivid picture this is. Marcia and I got a copy of the great old film, Gone with the Wind. I don't know whether you've gotten any of that since it's become available on VCR. And we watched it the other night. And as I was reading through this passage this week, I was reminded of the scenes of the burning of Atlanta. Do you remember that? What a tremendous, tremendous picture that was of destruction. You remember the bells were clanging and the sirens were wailing and the women were screaming and horses were bolting and plunging and going around corners and dumping barrels off of wagons and people were running and smoke was billowing and flames were roaring and there were explosions and buildings collapsing and more explosions and fire everywhere. Well, that's the picture that is being drawn here of the terrible burning. And along with the cries of the captains and the kings, we hear the croaking of the merchants. 18:11 through 13. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Then it lists all the various cargoes, gold, silver, articles of ivory, cinnamon, spice, and even human souls, slavery. And then we note in 15 that the merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. You note the compassion of the merchants here. It's like you go to the place where you've been doing all of your shopping and you say, oh, you develop a relationship with the shopkeeper. You say, a terrible thing has happened. I've gone bankrupt. And the merchant says, oh no, that's terrible. Oh, you won't be able to buy anything from me anymore. This is what's afoot here. The merchants see the burning of the great city, the collapse of the great system that has made them wealthy, and their only thought is for themselves. Well, why are they crying as captains and kings, and why are they croaking as merchants? 8:14 tells us the answer. The fruit for which thy soul longed has gone from thee, and all thy dainties and thy splendor are lost to thee, never to be found again. All thy dainties lost. Terrible. That means no more chocolate souffle with whipped cream. What has happened here? You've lost, it says, what your soul longed for. Now watch this, because the way John does this is very skillful. We instinctively know that the world is hostile and uncertain and full of danger. And for that reason, we just as instinctively search for refuges, for places where we will be safe. We get a place in the country and we fix it up with a year's supply of food and water so that when those who haven't done that come around begging, we can close the doors. We look for a place of refuge, someplace outside of the city. So we look for refuge in places. We look for refuge in institutions, governments, and even churches can be places where we seek to find refuge. We look for refuge in relationships, a friend or maybe even a mate. We look for refuge, of course, in money, and we say, if I can just stack it up high enough, if I can just get enough CDs downtown in the bank, then they'll never be able to get me. Now, the thing that all of this refuge searching has in common is we believe that all of these things that we're placing our faith in are reliable. They're all reliable. Nothing could ever happen to all of that. Now, all of this caterwauling that we read about here in chapter 18 is a consequence of people discovering that the things they have relied upon have collapsed in one hour. All the years of building and molding and cultivating and scraping and stealing and hiding and hoarding are gone in a moment. Now that sounds dumb, doesn't it? I mean, as Christians, we would never do anything like that, would we? We would not ever put our faith in those kinds of things. I heard a story about Luther this past week. When Luther was at the height of his unpopularity, he was taken by his friends and hidden away in a castle out in the country because they had a contract out on him. They were going to kill him. And so they surrounded the castle with his followers, and they were guarding his life. Luther stayed there for a while and began to go bananas. He just couldn't stand it. So he left the fastness of the castle, went back into the city, and back into the fray, and that's when he wrote that incredibly powerful hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, a Bulwark Never Fails, Our Helper He Amid the Flood of Mortal Ill Prevailing." Let's look this one in the face. Now, you know, you can blow this by me because I can't read your mind and I can't read your heart. But let me ask you this question, because I've asked myself this question this week. What is the fruit for which your soul is longing? What is the food for which you are perishing from hunger? What is the water for which you are dying of thirst? What is it, in other words, that you are investing your life in? Now, are you like David, who in the Psalms said, "I thirst for thee," speaking of God, "as a deer pants for water"? And the picture is of a great buck that is run until it's exhausted and its tongue is hanging out and it's perishing for the water. And David says, "This is the living water that I pant for." Or you like Paul, who said in one of his letters, he said, "Look, I don't want you guys to misunderstand how it was for me in Asia. We were so utterly, unbearably crushed, we despaired of life itself. But that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." Now, are the things that we are putting our faith in of that level of power, our institutions and our relationships and our places and our money, have the power to raise us from the dead. If they don't, then we're relying on a second level of power. Here's the principle that I see in this. Whatever you long for, you rely on when the chips are really down. Whatever you long for, whatever you're investing your life in, that's what you rely on when the chips are really down. Are you sometimes amazed when you see a Christian brother or Christian sister who is spiritually more mature than you are, been walking more deeply and longer with the Lord than you have, who hits some great disaster, who loses his or her business, all the money is gone, who loses his or her health, all of their health is gone, who loses power, who maybe even loses a beloved mate and still isn't destroyed? As Paul said, struck down, but not destroyed. Do you see that it's because they have been able to place their faith, as the great old song says, in Jesus, the rock in a weary land. Jesus is a rock in a weary land, a shelter in a time of storm. And this passage reminds us of the importance of placing our faith there and no place else, because nothing else will last. It will all be gone in an hour. The chorus then is a chorus of things that are no more. And we'll close with this. 18, 21 through 23. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so shall Babylon the great city be thrown down with violence and shall be found no more. And the sound of the harpers and the minstrels and the flute players and trumpeters shall be heard in thee no more, and a craftsman of any craft shall be found in thee no more. Listen to the way this echoes. This is marvelously constructed. Shall be found in thee no more, and the sound of the millstone shall be heard in thee no more, and the light of a lamp shall be shining in thee no more, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall be heard in thee no more. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, and all nations were deceived by their sorcery. You know, this reminds me of the way Poe constructed the raven, both the raven, nevermore. Now, what are these pleasures, and why are they the ones that are denied? Well, they're the earthly delights, of course, which were provided properly by God for man's enjoyment. But they've been twisted and perverted by man as he insisted on life without God. Let's look quickly at just two or three of them by way of illustration. First, at the thing itself and what God intended it to be for us, and then how man has perverted it. The first thing we see is music. Marcia and Nancy and I went down to Jones Hall last night and heard Pinchas Zukerman play Beethoven's violin concerto fantastic. Almost as good as John Drury singing up here, Jerusalem. Yes, not quite, but almost as good. Something that elevates and sustains the spirit. You feel like your head is humming when you come away from that. A beautiful gift which was used in a marvelous way. Surely, something like the gift of music, man couldn't find a way to pervert, could he? Turn on one of your rock stations on the way home. Hear it for yourself. Absolute filth pouring out of the radio. Sure, music has been perverted. Well, what about the craftsman? This is the genius of man that creates from all of the things that God has given him to work with. It can take, if it's properly used, magnificent forms, art, soaring cathedral, down to the poignant beauty of Michelangelo's Pietà, erected to the glory of God. But on the other hand, what kind of perversion do you see? Well, this book begins with it, the Tower of Babel, of course. And from the Tower of Babel, the slums of Calcutta. The worship of luxury and pleasure has all created monuments to the glory of man, which have been twisted in a way to create tremendous suffering. The light, which is spoken of here, there shall be no light anymore. This is the God-given ability to see, to strive, to accomplish, and to do. All of that comes from God. And if man takes that, allows the light of God to flow through him, then magnificent things are done with the human life and the divine power. But if man takes that same light and twists it and perverts it and denies the truth, if he perverts the light of truth and insists on living in ignorance, he squanders it on power and wealth, then we see the results. Someone said to me the other day, have you noticed that you're getting older? And I said, yeah, I have noticed that. You have too. You and I must be really perceptive people. He said, yeah, we are. You know what we're really doing? We're trading our youth in on something. It's like trading an old car in on something. Except in this case, we're trading something new in on something old, because I can see the body, you know, beginning to slowly collapse. And he said, I wonder what it is that we're trading our youth for. He said, I think we're supposed to be trading it in on wisdom. Now, that's a pretty good way to see that. Are we really doing that? That's the light of God. We trade our youth for wisdom if we walk according to His light. And then finally, of course, he closes with the reference to the voice of the bride and of the bridegroom, which is particularly poignant because this speaks of the most sacred and fundamental of all human relationships, because the bride and the bridegroom is the picture of the relationship between Christ and His church, between Christ and the believer. Well, surely man couldn't pervert that. Well, that's the thing that's been perverted, of course, most of all, with the parades of bedroom partners producing a syrupy supply of songs. I think that music really does illustrate a good deal about our culture, and songs particularly, and I just picked three at random. You could have picked any others. Julio Iglesias and Willie Nelson have blessed us with something called "To All the Girls I've Loved." This is one of the popular songs. You all know the lyrics. Who wandered in and out my door. See, I mean, just come and go, friends. The door's always open to you good-looking chicks. And then he speaks to all the girls who shared my life. And then he gets in a dig. Now it's someone like his wife. See, I got there first, friend, is what he's saying. Well, if that's not enough, there was an earlier one that said, "It's knowing that your door," the door again is open here, "it's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk that makes me want to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch." Isn't that wonderful? See, this is a guy singing to a girl. And then he goes and he says, and you and I both agree that we're not going to be bound by some ink stains that are stained upon some line, are we? See, that's the marriage contract. We're not going to have to fool around with that. And he said, let me tell you, he closes by saying, you know what all this, it makes you gentle on my mind. Makes you gentle. And the girls don't get off either. See, this is not strictly macho stuff, because there was another really wonderful lyric that a woman sang that began with advice that she got from her father. Do you remember this one? "Daddy," he once told me, "don't you love you any man? Just take what he can give you and give but what you can. And I don't love you, but we'll stay together 1 year. And then what's going to happen? Well, I'm going to be on my way, baby. I'm hitting the trail." See, the women can hit the trail too. And the consequence of all of that, we can sing in the sunshine. See, we're going to laugh every day. That's the lie. Does it smell like smoke? It ought to. Comes from the pit of hell, see? There's nothing to it. See, all this is just profanity and blasphemy. See, that's all that is. And we buy it. Because it sounds so good. Well, the blessings become cursings. What is the Christian reaction to all of this? Well, we rejoice. It says in 1820, we rejoice. 1820 is in here. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, saints and apostles and prophets, for God is giving judgment against her." We rejoice when God judges sin, don't we? Particularly when he judges some guy like Hitler, because he's a big target and easy to hate. Do we rejoice when God judges sin in our own lives? Paul says in his letter to the Corinthians that everybody builds on the foundation of Christ. That's the only foundation we can build on. But we can either build with gold, silver, and precious jewels, or we can build with wood and hay and stubble. And the divine fire is going to come along and burn all of that up. Do we rejoice when God burns the dross out of our lives? Sometimes I have a lot harder time with that kind of rejoicing. I want to close with a quote from a book on Revelation by Dr. H.A. Ironside, which sums up in just a few sentences what is being said in chapters 17 and 18. "Nimrod builded a city and a tower, as we have seen, and it became the mother city from whence others went out and built a civilization godless and selfish. That system eventually crucified the Lord of glory, and his accusation, King of the Jews, was written above him in Hebrew, the language of religion, Greek, the language of culture, and Latin, the language of politics. The world arrayed against God and his Christ. And this is the world which is to reach its culmination in Babylon the Great, presided over by the greatest geniuses that earth has ever produced." These guys are not dummies. The greatest geniuses that earth has ever produced will create this civilization, only to be judged by God because of its inveterate enmity to everything holy, its constant rejection of his Son. Its downfall will prepare the way for the establishment of the kingdom of God and the reign of righteousness and peace for which humanity has sighed so long. Man's city must fall to give place to the city of God, which will stand forever. Babylon, then, the decayed, decadent, corrupt city of man, must be destroyed, to make way for the new Jerusalem, the radiant and glorious city of God. It's happened in history past. It's going to happen in history future. If you will allow it, it can happen in your life. Let's thank God for that. Father, we thank you today for your faithfulness, and we thank you for your word. We're looking forward now to continuing the study of your word, Lord, as we begin the portion which deals with the glorious coming of your Son. And it's in his name that we thank you this morning. Amen.